Welcome to the 73 Dream Studios Variety Show.
All right. Welcome to Horror Hotel. And today, we're going to be covering Friday the 13th, Part 2. What else will we be covering? It is Friday the 13th. It's a special Friday the 13th episode. And of course, returning to our bonus episode series, it's me, Ray.
And your girl, Cicely.
Welcome back, Cicely. It's your first time with me as the owner of this podcast.
This is true.
Yes. I suppose you've already received the memo about the new contract, right?
Sure.
I mean, to be fair, you technically didn't have a contract before, but all right. Well, as long as that's clear, then I'm comfortable moving forward. All right. So I'm gonna go over the quick facts and the cast key. Cast key isn't super important because I'm gonna be honest with you, I don't remember hardly anyone in this film. Do you?
No.
Yeah, that's fair. So, quick facts. And also, of course, full spoiler warning, we're going to be covering all of this. Feel free to check out Friday the 13th Part 2. It is available, I believe, on Paramount Plus. So if you have Paramount Plus, watch it there. Otherwise, you're probably going to have to pay, $5. I think that's how much it cost us. I think it was like $4 or $5 to rent on Apple TV, which probably the same price on YouTube and Vudu and all of them. Either way, if you want, you can watch it. If not, my apologies, we're about to spoil the whole goddamn thing. So quick facts, Steve Miner was the director, Ron Kurtz was the writer, however, credit-wise, they are all based off of characters by Victor Miller, the director/writer of the first Friday the 13th. Producers were Steve Miner with production company Georgetown Productions. Peter Stein was cinematographer. Susan E. Cunningham was the editor. Harry Manfredini was the music director. This was distributed by Paramount Pictures on May 1st, 1981. It's a runtime of 1 hour, 27 minutes. It had a budget of $1.25 million, quite a large difference from the first film. And it had a box office of $21.7 million. All right. And just going to go over 5 members of the cast. It's a much larger cast than that, but these are the 5 important ones to remember. You have Amy Steele as Ginny Field. Ginny being, again, spoiler alert, she's the final girl for this film. She is, in fact, the final girl of this film.
Can't go without him.
Then we have Johnny Ferrey as Paul Holt. Paul is the director of a camp counselor training camp, I guess, is the premise of this film and this character. We have Adrian King returning as Alice Hardy, the final girl from the first Friday the 13th. We'll get into her story in a minute. We have, and then we have the unsung hero, or unsung villain, I should say, Steve Daskowitz as Jason Voorhees. And the reason he's unsung is he's not actually credited. They credited him as the stunt double, even though he's literally Jason for the majority of the film. The person who normally gets credited for being Jason is Warrington Gillette, because he played Jason Voorhees when he was unmasked at the end of the film.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, like the last 4 or 5 minutes of the film, and apparently that's all that mattered. You're credited as Jason for the whole film now. All right, so now we're going to jump right into the plot. So once again, Paramount Plus or rent it, either way, this is your final warning. We are covering the entire plot of this film right now. Now, I'm going to say right now, the timeline of this film, this is before the era of like making it very clear what time this happened. They don't have timestamps or anything, so I'm just going to say it. You're not going to see it, but I'm going to say it. The opening of the film where we follow up with Alice Hardy, it's 2 months after the events of the first film. Again, something we didn't know.
Yeah, we would have never been able to guess that. Like, we could tell that it was definitely, like, what we could tell that the previous events from the previous movie had been recent to this next movie, but that was, like, that was pretty much all we were going off of.
Yeah, like, at first I thought it was going to be, because we focus on Alice Hardy in, like, a brand new apartment, and I'm like, okay, is this, like, the next day? Did she get released from the hospital? Because, for those that don't know, she was the only survivor of Mrs. Voorhees in the first film, and she was traumatized because she believes Jason was still at the lake, which I don't think that actually happened to her, because in the first film, Jason was still a boy. But that's clearly not the case for this film and all the films going forward.
Right.
So she definitely just, like, had a heart attack or something and envisioned that shit. But basically, 2 months later, she's in a new apartment. She's on the phone with her mom. Mom's being overbearing, as most moms are. And you can just hear Alice kind of be like, "Ma, I need to get on with my life. Yes, it was awful, but I can't keep living like that. I need to live my life, and this is the only way I know how." Yeah. And you can tell the mom's interrupting her, and then she's just like, "I'll call you tomorrow, Mom." And those would be the last words that Alice would say to her mother.
Yeah, because they didn't pay her for very much screen time in this movie, guys.
God, no. Adrienne King, it's still, like, not conclusive why. But because Adrienne King herself says that the reason she didn't even want to do this film was because that she had stalkers from the first film.
Oh, love that.
Yeah, there were fans of the first film that would, like, be obsessed with her. And she was like, "I don't want to keep doing that. Like, I'm going to show up, you're going to kill me off, and that's it." But according to other people, Adrienne King had actually wanted more money than the studio was willing to pay her. So they were like, "All right, we'll pay you for one day of filming." And then they killed her off so she could never come back. Oh my God. So Jason shows up. Like, first there's, like, a lot of, like, teases. Like, "Ooh, is something going to happen? No. Is something going to happen? No." And then Alice opens her refrigerator door, and it's the severed head of Pamela Voorhees. The head that she herself cut off with a machete in the prior film. Just Jay chilling in the fridge.
Yeah. Because that makes sense.
So she freaks out. Jason actually walks up on her, stabs her in the neck with an ice pick. And sorry, not to the neck. It was her head. I think it was her head.
Yeah, it was, like, in her temple.
Yeah, brains her and fucking... And we move on. So following the same scenario as we did with the first film, hey, we're going to focus on one character. You're going to think that it's this character's story. And just kidding, they're dead. Moving on to a whole ensemble cast.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, and again, what happens next? Time cards would have been very useful, because I thought this was, like, the next day. And no, I find out that when the rest of this movie takes place 5 years after Alice died. So I'm just like, what? At what point was it established that this was 5 years in the future?
It was never established.
So we got Paul. He's opened up his school for camp counselors. And where do you open up a school for camp counselors? But in a location very near to where camp counselors were slaughtered.
Yeah, that's obviously, like, the first reasonable thought that you would come up with. Naturally.
I mean, in Paul's defense, I'm sure the rent for the land was cheap.
Yeah, probably.
Like, goddamn. Land wasn't cheap even in the 1980s, people. So let's see. I got the list here of the counselors' names. I'm going to forget all of them immediately.
Yes.
the counselors in training. Let's see. We got Sandra, her boyfriend Jeff, we got Scott, Terry, Mark, Vicky, Ted. And I think one of those people is supposed to be one of Paul's assistants, but the main assistant is Ginny, who shows up late. Immediately, all eyes on her. She got that red convertible car, pulls up. It's making a shit ton of noise. And Paul's just like, "Oh my God, this bitch. I'm totally gonna fuck her, but this bitch." Were you getting that vibe that Paul was like, he was both sick of her shit and also was like, "Oh yeah, I hired her because I wanted to bang her"?
No.
I was immediately getting those vibes. I was like, Paul cannot stand this woman, but he also really likes this woman.
I don't like to assume what men are thinking, because they're never thinking anything intelligent.
I wouldn't say he was thinking anything intelligent. I feel like that was the most, that was both the most illogical way of thinking, but I feel like at least a number of men that listening to this are like, that adds up. That makes sense. Good move, Paul. Paul's going to live, right? Okay. All right, so, there's some talks, and one of my favorite scenes was? They brought the Doomsayer back from the first film. The guy that was in town that literally warns people, like, don't go to Camp Crystal Lake. You're doomed. You'll all die. And then literally, like, we show him talking to the camp counselors, and he's just like, I tried warning him before. They didn't listen. We're all doomed. And I'm just like, all right, is anyone going to listen to this guy? No.
Of course not.
No one's going to listen to this guy.
There wouldn't be a movie if we listened to this guy.
But you know what? Apparently someone decided, yo, we can't take the risk that someone's going to listen to this fucker. We got to kill him. So this guy's being a little weird. He's like checking out the campers from the woods. And then he's like, I forget how he was killed off. Was he just strangled to death?
I honestly don't know off the top.
It's Crazy Ralph. That's what he is. Not strangled. It was a garrote wire, which I thought was really weird. I found it very odd that was the weapon of choice, a garrote wire. For those that don't know, garrote wires, they are like razor sharp wires that you'll wrap around someone's throat, and instead of strangling them, usually you're cutting into their throat.
Any Hitman players know where it's at.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Or Sonya Blade from Mortal Kombat. But yeah, so Jason's going like old school. Like if you see modern films, that's usually not Jason's style. Jason's usually like a machete, a corkscrew. No, he's busting out a garrote wire.
You know, he decided to go out of his norm for this dude, because he was like, this dude knows a little too much.
But that's the thing, this is the first film where Jason's the killer.
That's true.
Like, he's doing, and like you even said, he's doing it Hitman style, ice picks, garrote wires.
Yeah.
I really want to know, like, and I'm sure we'll learn more the more into this series we get. But I really want to know the evolution of this dude went from, like, Hitman-style kills to
complete gore.
To I don't even give a fuck. Yeah. I'm going to bash someone's brains in with a never-human body. Like, oh my gosh. So, they have the camp, after Crazy Ralph's death, we have the campfire story about, well, we had some slaughters on the other side of this lake. Yeah, that's true. This whole training camp is happening by Camp Crystal Lake. Again, location, 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 motherfucker. Like, so they tell the story of Jason Voorhees, the boy who drowned, his mother going on that vengeful killing spree, both in 1958, which was not on film. That was just something that was alluded to, I believe. Oh, no, wait, it was on film, because it was the two camp counselors that got murdered in the very beginning of the first Friday the 13th film.
Right.
And then the murder spree of 1979, until she herself was eventually murdered. So if this is 5 years later, this means the events of the film are taking place in 1984. Just to be clear on that.
That's how that math works.
All right, so according to legend, Jason survived and is now living in the woods near Crystal Lake, which I don't know how that story started. Like, how did that story start? That Jason's alive? Everyone was accepting of the fact that Jason died. But now it's like, oh yeah, Mrs. Voorhees was the killer. And there have been zero killings since Mrs. Voorhees was murdered. But, ooh, Jason Voorhees was really alive all along, hiding in those woods.
I mean, is he really alive, though?
That is the story. And, like, to be fair, we have never actually seen him die up to this point. So I feel like that's the horror movie rule. If you don't see a body, then they're not dead.
Right.
Like, you could end them. I've seen movies end, and they're just like, nope, we never saw a body. And I'm just like, I'm not counting it. I'm not counting that death. If I don't see a goddamn body or a decapitated head or something, they're missing. They're not dead. They're not alive. They're missing. So, but that's what these guys are saying. They're like, hey, we never found a body. Jason's alive. He's in the woods. Clearly something's going to happen here. he's going to kill anyone he comes across. Just another urban legend within this film. Paul finishes the story, and we get Ted scaring everyone, classic campfire nonsense. Paul's reassuring everyone, hey man, I was just kidding. Jason's dead. But just in case, though, don't go in the woods. Don't even go to Camp Crystal Lake.
Just to be safe.
You know what? Now that I think about it, literally never leave. Just never leave. So now, the following day, Jeff and Sandra, that couple, they're sneaking off to Camp Crystal Lake, and they find the carcass of a dog. And I know one of the other, I forget who, but one of those other counselors in training had a dog. So I'm just like, ah, shit. Is the dog dead? The dog's dead, man. Deputy finds them, and later on, the deputy spotted a man wearing a burlap sack mask, and he chases that man, finds a whole shack, and then he just gets a hammer claw, the claw of a hammer, like dug into the back of his skull. So we got another death, which, I mean, let's face it, the deputy was kind of a douche.
Yeah.
But I love when he's like, these kids need to be punished. They need to be disciplined. And the Paul is just like, Ginny, make sure that they don't get seconds on their dessert. Like, that's the punishment.
Yeah.
Like, and he's just like, that's right. God damn it. I don't know why I gave him a Vince McMahon voice. That was not his voice. That was a Vince McMahon voice right there. So and to be clear, none of these counselors have actually been trained yet. They're literally just living their fucking life.
Yeah, they're all just Jay chilling there, like just living a vida loca.
Right? So Paul is like, all right, kids, we're all going to go on one last night on the town before your training starts. In other words, they're going to get fucking hammered.
Yeah.
They're going to the bar. It says six people stay behind. I thought there was only four.
I did not count.
I know the couple stayed behind because that was supposed to be part of their punishment for sneaking out. The guy in the wheelchair stayed behind, and the girl that really liked him stayed behind. And I guess there was supposed to be two more, but I'm blanking on who the other two were. I'll get into that. But at the bar, Ginny is being the final girl, the token final girl, and just being like, but what if that story's true? Just imagine. Jason was in the woods all along, his mother never knowing, just killing people in his name. And then Jason just sees her get killed. He would have the mind of a child, and he would never even know the concept of death until he saw his mother die. And meanwhile, everyone there is like, you're drunk. You're drunk, Ginny. Just shut the fuck up. You're drunk. So once again, a character's not that far off base from what's actually potentially the truth.
Right.
And everyone's like, shut the fuck up. That's ridiculous.
Because it's a woman.
That's true. Ginny is a woman. And in the 1980s, women's opinions meant nothing.
How dare you speak?
Pretty much, yeah. So, as they're having all this talk, the quote-unquote assailant, let's face it, we all know it's Jason, he's killing off the counselors one by one. Let's see. So it says Scott has throat slit with a machete while caught in a rope trap.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to remember here. So were they not the couple? Oh no, Scott was the perv. That's right. Scott was the perv.
Yeah, he was trying to get with the girl.
He was trying to get with another girl, and it was Terry, I believe. Scott trying to get with Terry. And he, like, because Terry went for a nude swim. Yeah, that's where the film gets its R rating. Actually, not all, because it got its R rating for violence, if you could believe that. But there's full frontal nudity with Terry. And so he steals her clothes, and she's trying to chase him. He gets his leg caught in a rope trap. Terry's like, well, I'm going to go get help or something. And then Scott just gets his throat slit by a machete.
Yeah, rightfully so.
And rightfully so. Wow. are you going by the theory of the theory that people in horror movies, it's the sinners that die? Is that where you're pulling from, or do you just not like Scott?
I mean, it depends on the context. In this context, I would say Scott, Terry. I don't even know who
Scott. Scott's the guy.
Okay. I was like, all the fucking names are so generic that they could be assigned to anybody.
The writers were like, anyone can play these roles. All that matters is Jason.
But the guy in this sense definitely deserved to die, so...
Well, then supposedly Terry died, but I don't know if we ever saw her body. I genuinely didn't even know that she died, and then you were like, well, the camera zoomed in on her and she was screaming.
Yeah, because she obviously went back to go and, because she left in the first place to, like, find a knife to cut him down, and by the time she got back, he was obviously dead. And when she turned around, that was exactly what happened. She just screamed towards the camera.
Yep, so... I'm not buying it. Terry might still be alive, unless somewhere further along our notes, we discover that we found Terry's body at some point. I don't think they did, but if we wrote that down and I just forgot, then oh well. But so Wheelchair Kid, I really don't know if they intended for his death to be a fucking comedy scene. But oh my god, that like he's literally just wheeling along. He wheels outside after having some heavy flirtation with the other girl, and it's just because, you know, it's that classic disabled man flirting with woman, and the woman's like, hey, so you can't walk, but does everything else down there work? How many movies have you seen featuring a disabled person has a line like that come up?
I really could not tell you. I have not, unfortunately. I have not stored those movies in a memory bank in my mind where I could say, oh yeah, exactly 2.5 films I've watched.
2.5.
Has included that exact line.
I know you just picked a random number, but why is there a decimal in there?
You know, that's just the algorithm my brain decided to choose.
Oh my gosh. So fucking, I feel so bad not knowing his name. It's nothing against people that are disabled. It's just no one in this movie was fucking memorable. Fuck it. So Wheelchair Kid is just wheeling along outside. Like, hey, bitch, where'd you go? And then Jason's right there, froze machete. And of course, because makeup department could only do well with what they had at the time. For their time, this was a great shot. Modern day, we just cut to a machete already in Wheelchair Kid's face as he goes, ah! And then we have a wheelchair. Somehow, I forget how this worked. I think Jason had to have moved the wheelchair, because there's no fucking way. But because didn't the wheelchair fall forward, not backward?
I do not remember, to be honest.
Either way, but we literally just see a nice shot of him in his wheelchair falling down a long flight of stairs.
It was the scene was longer than I was expecting it to be.
Just
I was like expecting it to cut at some point, and he just kept going. I was like, damn, how many fucking stairs is he gonna roll down?
This might as well have been a fucking Looney Tune. Like, what?
Yeah, they could have really, they missed the opportunity to add some silly sound effects in this moment. They also missed an opportunity to drop a whole piano on him too.
And then we all... A piano. Oh my god. My apologies, I need to collect myself after that visual.
I'm just imagining it now, like da 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 da.
You see a wheelchair pop out in a spring. Woo woo woo. Someone hire me, not to do voice acting, but to just make those noises.
Yeah, honestly, we'd be great at doing that.
Just like how we discussed in a prior podcast where I went for Death on the Nile, where I could also be the background guy that goes, oh, shit!
Exactly. You'll just add the extra ad-libs if needed.
Yep. It'll all be improv. Give me a script. Let me just be there and react, and you got your film. Anyway... So, Jeff and Sandra have a couple, of course, because they're a couple, they're gonna have sex.
Wow.
And of course, because they're having sex, they
unholy!
Exactly, they have to die.
This is actually, like, this has the potential to be, like, an abstinency like type of video where religious people are like, this is what happens if you have sex before marriage.
Exactly.
You die.
You're having premarital sex. Well,
you get murdered.
You're gonna have a harpoon or whatever the fuck it was stabbed between the two of you. You refuse to wait till you're bonded in holy matrimony. You're bonded in the gore of the spear. All right, and now after that, with that visual, that's the visual that whoever the last girl, not the final girl, that's Jenny, but the last girl that stayed behind of the six, she walks in to find them dead. And I'm just gonna look at these notes. Did she walk in? Did she ever find Terry's body? That's bothering me. Did she ever find Terry's body?
Nobody gives a fuck about Terry.
No, it doesn't look it. And we get the last girl and weakest fucking death ever because Jason's literally just walking forward with a knife. And she's literally just like, oh my God, no. Like, plenty of time to just get up and like kick this guy in the nuts or like just run. Like, we made fun of Alice in the final movie. At least Alice did something.
Yeah, she did a lot more.
She put so much effort in compared to this bitch. She was just like, I wanted to die anyway. Come on, bring it on.
That was probably like her 10th take, and she was just really tired of having to do nothing but scream.
They're just like, well, okay, like, we get it. We understand that you in the situation would get up and do something. But this is acting, Deborah. You have to stay there. Like, you're in shock.
They just gave her no fucking direction besides scream and be scared.
I need you to scream and be scared. Oh my God. No, I did not tell you to move, bitch. I said scream and be scared. That's it. God damn it. I don't give a shit how close that camera gets to you. You scream even louder.
Oh my gosh.
All right, so she screams. We're pretty sure she's dead.
Sure.
I don't know if we see a body on this one, but we're pretty sure she's dead.
Safe to assume.
All right, now for the smartest guy in this film. We cut back to the bar. Jenny and Paul, they're like, yeah, we should go back to camp. Jenny being the designated driver, because once again, even though she's accused of being drunk, I don't think we ever actually see her drink anything. Even if she did, it was the 1980s. You want to drink and drive? Go for it. I'm not condoning it in modern day, because as we now know, that's not okay. But 1980s? Fuck it. Who cared about the laws of a road back then?
Nobody, and that still holds pretty true now.
We don't condone it, but...
No.
But so, and now the smartest guy in the film, though, fucking Ted, is just like... Because they literally tell Ted, hey, wrap up, at like, have, like, this place closes in like a half hour, come back straight back to camp. Ted's like, yeah, sure. They leave, and he goes, and he sees another patron, and he's just like, hey, there any after-hours places around here? Yeah, there's plenty. Perfect. Like, and that is the story of how Ted lived, and would go on to meet your mother.
He grew on to create TED Talks.
Yep. Oh, my God. So, Paul and Jenny come back, and camp's in disarray. Killer's out there. The next scene is like a fever dream to me, because it seems like there's no real flow. Like, oh, hey, they find some bodies. Jason shows up. Jason's attacking them. At one point, Jason, again, burlap sack over the head, is attacking Paul, and Jenny is continuing the trend of women just doing nothing in the face of danger. She's literally just watching Paul possibly get murdered, and she's like, oh no.
She's too stunned to speak, besides the screaming. She's just standing there.
She can't move. She's like, you sure I can't just like punch him in the back of the head? No, Jenny, you're a woman. You wouldn't do that. Like, but I would do that, Jenny. No, you wouldn't. I'm the director here. Like,
you're just gonna stand there and look pretty.
Just stand there, look pretty, look terrified, and wait for your scene. All right? Capiche. Drama queens, am I right? Anyway. So, Paul is seemingly killed. Jason gets up, chases Jenny. Jenny's booking it. Jenny somehow randomly finds Jason's shack. She, like, tries to barricade the door. Jason's trying to break the door down. And what's in the shack?
Good old mama dear.
Or at least her head. And her sweater, of all the things to keep.
Yes.
I love how there's no body. Like, Jason easily could have got the body if he actually witnessed that death. But he's like, I just want the sweater.
And somehow this woman is able to put two and two together. And she's like, yeah, that's gotta be his mom.
That's definitely his mom.
And it, she...
It's not the head of another victim.
Her instant... yeah, and there's other bodies in there, too. It wasn't just the head.
Right?
Like, there was other female bodies in there.
You know what? That was probably Terry.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was gonna say.
All right, but Terry's dead. It's confirmed.
There was other female bodies in there. And her first reaction is, let me put on the sweater.
And then try to make my hair match Vedette the fucking carcass's hair. I don't know how that fucking skull still has hair 5 years later.
Yeah, for real.
And then she's just like, and Jason breaks in. She's like, Jason, dear, you did very good. You made mommy proud. And I'm just like, how does she even know what the mom sounds like?
Yeah, for real.
This bitch is literally going off so many assumptions. And Jason doesn't even buy it at first. Jason's like, sounds like mom. But nah, I'm gonna kill you. And she's like, Jason, don't make mommy upset. And and Jason's just like, oh shit, she is mom. So, and then, like, Ginny's, like, what was Ginny trying to do? Was she gonna kill Jason?
Yeah, she tries to kill him eventually in this moment.
Like, she goes forward towards him. And then, like, when she moved, Jason sees his mom's skull in the background. And he's like, hold up.
Wait a minute.
I'm a kill bitch. And so they're struggling. And then who comes to save the day? It's Paul.
Does he save the day, though?
I mean, not really.
I mean,
they fuck shit up. Yeah. Like, that whole shack is coming down. And then finally, Ginny, like, takes a pickaxe, was it?
No,
Jason had the pickaxe.
Yeah.
Jason's about to kill Paul with a pickaxe. Ginny's got the machete. And she slams it down. I thought she got him in the neck. But according to notes, it says that she got him in the shoulder.
Yeah.
And apparently that was enough to kill him. Which I'm just like, hold up. You telling me a machete? Like, I mean, I've never taken a machete to the shoulder. I'm not going to fucking volunteer to experience this. But are you telling me a machete to the shoulder is enough to kill you?
Kill Jason, specifically.
The man who survived drowning and then lived in the woods for years, since 1958, he supposedly died. No, sorry, the teenagers were killed in 1958. He drowned the year before, so 1957. It's 1984, so almost a full 30 years he survived in the woods by himself.
Yes.
Just to witness his mother die, which, if he could fucking see that camp the whole time, why didn't he just talk to someone?
You know, that's a good question. Therapy.
He literally could see his mom, who was a volunteer at the camp. You telling me he never went to his mama?
Not until she died.
He's like, yeah, you know, I think today's the day. I'm finally going to see my mom. Walks in.
Mama.
Oh, I'm going to kill bitches now. Okay. All right. So, Jason seemingly dead. Paul and Ginny are back at the cabin. But they hear something outside. What's outside? What's outside? It's a dog. It's Terry's dog, Muffin.
Of course.
Yep. So, and they're like, oh, yay, that's perfect. And then Jason bursts through the goddamn window.
Because why would he be dead, guys?
Except, was that even real? Because then Ginny wakes up and she's in a fucking ambulance.
Honestly, what is real in this film?
That's literally what happened to Alice. Like, it's like, jump scare. Just kidding. It was a dream. Ginny's just, like, suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Honestly, like, it's, like, as, like, oh my fucking god. That stroke tasted amazing. There is, like, the films definitely showcase that Jason is definitely not human. And the fact that he experiences some form of, like, he deals with some form of mental health.
Yeah.
Because he's able to hear his dead mother, and he's also able to sustain injuries and survive. And he's also able, I mean, I don't know if this could be necessarily connected to him, I would assume so, but He's also able to basically continue to paranoia his victims even after they survive him.
Right. Well, I mean, PTSD is real. Let's face it. But like Ginny literally just walked in, found all these campers murdered, and almost watched a guy that she's somewhat physically attracted to get murdered.
Yes.
But yeah, so I think obviously I didn't make the film, but I think what they were going for is that Jason is alive. Like, I think that was what they were constantly trying to imply, but being like, no, Jason was actually alive this whole time. Ooh. I think that's what they were going for. I think Jason was actually alive and that he just seemingly, like, because all the ways he kills people did not seem like an undead monster. It was like, no, he's literally slowly picking them off. He literally, he was acting the same way his mother did when she was killing people, separating them and just killing them one by one and doing it in like quick fashion. Ice pick to the temple, garrote wire to the throat, throw a machete in someone's face. Like, he very much was going for quick, decisive kills in this.
Yeah.
With that said, we end with a scene on the shack. We still have no clue what happened to Paul, so I guess we don't know what happened to Paul after all that. And in the notes, it does say that Jason's body is nowhere to be found when we go back to the shack. So what the fuck actually happened? And the camera is just a still on Mrs. Voorhees' face. And yeah, that's the end of the second Friday the 13th movie. Before we cut to commercial, thoughts on the ending?
It was kind of lackluster, to be honest.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. But we don't want to end on that lackluster note, so we're going to cut away to a quick sponsor, and then we're going to be going over fun facts and some questions. And we're back. All right. So, you ready for these fun facts and questions? I got five of each.
I suppose.
All right. Fun fact one. Part two was originally meant to turn Friday the 13th into an anthology series, with each film meant to depict another tragic event falling on the eponymous date. Due to the shock and intrigue created by the first film's twist ending, though, audiences clamored to see the continuation of Jason's story, and so would begin the tradition of every film following Jason Voorhees.
I think it would have been interesting to see how their original ideas would have played out. Yeah. Not that Jason Voorhees isn't still an iconic villain, I guess you could call him, but I never thought that was going to be their original plan.
Yeah, right? Imagine how different the series would be because, and I don't know if it would have survived back in the 80s.
Right.
Because in the 80s, you at like most of the big franchises you see, they're focused on one person.
Yeah.
Whereas today, gosh, the biggest reference point that I could say for that time period, as far as anthologies go, would be Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
So maybe it was more like anthologies could work in television, maybe not necessarily in film. Is there, like, a film anthology series that you can think of that's successful? I can think of video games. I can think of even modern-day television. American Horror Story. Every season is a different event. Although they did have that big crossover season where it turned out that they were all within the same universe anyway. But I digress.
Yeah. I can't think of any right off the top of my head.
You trying to look it up?
Yeah. I mean, right off the bat, like, it shows me TV series, so it looks like it's not a very common thing for film series to do that.
So they definitely made a smart decision with having just sticking with Jason's story. Fun fact number two. Principal photography was roughly 2 months, taking from October to November of 1980. With the film released in May of 1981, it was just short of 1 year from the first film's release. Just imagine that. You make this big movie that made a shit ton of money, and you just sit back and you're like, we gotta get another one in less than a year.
Yeah, I feel like that's really ambitious.
Like, and I, like, I feel like it definitely suffered for it, because the first film was great. I mean, it's a cult classic. Second film, I don't know, man. I feel like the second film survived based off of Jason.
Yeah.
Fun fact number three, there was quite a bit of controversy as it was revealed that an early cut of the film featured full frontal nudity of a 16-year-old woman.
Ew.
Yeah, I thought that was shocking. Like, they literally, like, and there's rumors that there is still a cut of the film out there with that scene. Apparently, I'm pretty sure someone thought that another person had it, and they were like, you need to extend your copy to, like, this museum, because there's a whole museum that, like, tracks horror movie, like, memorabilia. And they're like, you need to send your cut of the film to this museum so they can enshrine it. And I'm just like, why? But apparently it's because it's considered, like, the original cut. Like, here's a 16-year-old naked girl that needs to be glorified, apparently.
I don't know who thought that was a good idea, but...
I wasn't born in the 80s, so I don't know what the laws were back then. But clearly, like, the Motion Picture Film Association was like, you ain't getting away with this. That's gotta be an X rating if you keep that shit in the film. Like, they were gonna give it an X rating for the violence alone. They had to cut quite a bit, like almost a full minute of violent scenes from this film to get their R rating. Fun fact number four. Originally, the script called for the head of Mrs. Voorhees opening its eyes and smiling towards the camera at the end, but was ultimately cut for coming across as too silly.
Really?
Yeah, you remember how at the end, they literally focus on Mrs. Voorhees' head for, like, felt like forever.
Yeah.
They were originally going to have her eyes open and smile.
I feel like that would have been creepy, not silly.
I feel like that would have been too much, considering they've done fake out, and they've already done a quote-unquote fake out ending. Because remember, supposedly Jason as a child popping out and attacking Alice was supposed to be a joke. It was supposed to be a joke ending at the end.
Right.
So they were like, no, we can't do this again. We can't do this again, guys. We can't make an ever joke ending. All right, last fun fact. Friday the 3rd. Oh, wait, so before I even say this, of the two films so far, what's the better one? The first Friday the 13th or the second?
Probably the first.
I'll go with that. And Rotten Tomatoes agrees. Fun fact number five, Friday the 13th Part 2 was given a 27% on Rotten Tomatoes. And by comparison, the first Friday the 13th received a 63%.
Interesting.
Alright, so now we're going to move on to the questions. Question number one. What were your thoughts on how Alice was used in this film?
Alice.
The final girl from the first film.
Oh. I don't know. I feel like they could have done a little bit more with her. I feel like she was definitely kind of a throwaway character. They were kind of just like, hey, here's the connection to the first movie, and she's gone.
Yeah. I understand why Jason would have gone out and would have sought her out. Because that's the first kill that Jason gets. That's supposedly the first kill Jason gets, period. But it's also his first kill, and so far only kill, that's outside of Camp Crystal Lake's area.
Yeah, which is very strange. Like, how the fuck did he find her, first of all?
I'm assuming he just stalked her, which, again, that's also interesting that she was killed by a stalker, and one of his alleged reasons she didn't come back, she didn't want to stay for the franchise, was because she had stalkers from the first film. Very tongue-in-cheek. So I thought that was interesting, and I do wish that she could have been used more, built her character up, but I do agree that in the end, she had to die. Like,
yeah, I feel like they just could have used her more.
Yeah, she was Jason's, like, fucking white whale, because she was the one that killed his mother. So she is both his reason for being a killer, and she's also, like, the first kill.
Yeah.
Question number two. How did you think Ginny, the final girl of this film, compared to Alice?
She definitely didn't seem as much of a strong last girl as Alice did. Like, she definitely didn't put as much of a fight up as we discussed previously.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Ginny, I feel like, was a bit smarter than Alice, though.
In what ways?
Like, as we complained in the first film, one of Alice's terrible traits was whenever she had the killer down, she would just run away. Like, she's like, I'm not finishing this. Ginny, while she was very pacifist in nature, which she ultimately got over, but I feel like they should have done more of that. They should have established that she was a pacifist, because then a lot of her fucking character flaws would have been forgivable. But the fact that she literally, like, she, as we discussed, it seems inane that she was able to do this, but she's able to put two and two together, be like, this is his mom. I need to, like, pretend to be his mom, and then he won't hurt me. Just, like, the fact that she's able to do that, and also the fact that she literally deduces why she gets into the psychology of Jason. Everyone else is just fit to be like, nah, he's either an urban legend or he's a psychopathic killer. Ginny is the only person who says, this is a lost boy who had to witness his mother die, and that was his first concept of death. And to go so long without having anyone to raise him to begin with, he probably has no concept of empathy. Like, yeah. She fully gets into the psychology of it.
Yeah, that's fair.
What's your opinion of Jason having actually been alive all this time?
My opinion?
Yeah.
I feel like it's kind of a weak solution. It's kind of a weak excuse to just have Jason be alive, I feel.
I agree, fully, because as we alluded to earlier, it's like, really? If he was alive all this time, why the fuck didn't he talk to someone? Like, those woods ain't that big. Where the fuck was he hiding?
I feel like it was just, like, their easiest solution, or, like, it was, like, the first thing that came to their mind, and they just ran with it, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, that's what it feels like.
Hey, man, y'all had 1 year to make a movie. You better fucking get that script typed up real quick. I mean, filming started in October, so, and the first film came out in May, so they basically had to have that script typed up in, like, 4 to 5 months.
Yeah.
Jeez. Just, and I do agree, it definitely seemed like a big cop-out, but at the same time, it's like, it was a cop-out, it was lazy, but we have one of the horror genre's greatest fucking icons from this laziness.
Yeah.
Do you think the inclusion of a disabled person was a positive for the film?
No. I don't think it added to the film at all.
Yeah, no. Like, there was so much they could have done, but, like, I get, like,
there was nothing serious about his character.
They stuck to cliches a lot.
Yeah.
Like, they very much stuck to cliches. The actor himself was pretty wooden in a lot of his performance. Except for when he was flirting with the girl, and I feel like that wasn't a performance, but...
Probably not.
Like, he didn't even get a chance to act afraid, because he literally dies instantly.
Yeah.
So, it may not have been a positive inclusion. At the same time, I mean, we didn't see a lot of disabled people being featured in the genre to begin with, so I guess it opened the door. Just wish that there was a bit more positivity and more of it you could have looked up to in this. Final question. What was the best kill?
Probably the pervy dude, just because he deserved it.
I'm going to say the garrote wire, and that's mostly because, like... I have so many questions. Where the fuck did he even get a garrote wire?
Who knows?
Like, is that just lying around the camp somewhere? Like...
Homemade.
Like, Jesus, but like you said, that was so Hitman-esque.
And also, the wheelchair dude's death was just amazing to
that
watch.
That was fun, but again, I feel like it should not have been fun.
No, I don't think they meant for it to be comedic, but it was.
We literally, like, we just watched a person who literally could not run away, just get shoved down the stairs after having a machete thrown in his face.
There's no way that he just rolled down the stairs as perfectly as he did without the wheelchair, like, just toppling him all the way backwards.
Yeah, I have no idea how they did that. Like, I mean, I doubt that that was an actual person in the wheelchair.
No, I would hope not.
But the fact that that, whatever they put in that wheelchair had to have had some weight to it for it to not to go fucking end over end like yeah. that. All right. Is there anything you would like to plug?
No, I don't think so.
No. Let's see. When is the next Friday the 13th? Because we only do these episodes on Friday the 13th. Let's see. Friday the 13th. Calendar. All right, so the next Friday the 13th is going to be in November. So we will be covering Friday the 13th. Part three in November. So that'll be fun. As for next week, as for this coming Tuesday, though, I'm going to be doing a grappling with Rey. So you guys will be able to tune into that. And the next horror hotel is going to be a very long ways away, actually, now that I'm looking at my notes. Good God. It's going to be at least a month. But Sicily, the next time you're back is going to be May 31st, because what did you and I watch just this past weekend?
The good old Doctor Strange Mom.
The Multiverse of Madness, yes. So, no spoilers on here, but we are going to have spoilers May 31st, when Sicily and I, and potentially JP, cover Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness on Comic Chatter. I've got a Mystery Motel scheduled for May 24th. I'm hoping JP can join, because he has yet to do a Mystery Motel with me. I really want to get that film mind in on it, but we'll see how it goes. But yeah, so your guys' homework. May 31st. By May 31st, catch Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness in theaters. No spoilers, but I will say it's definitely worth it. Would you say it's worth it?
Yeah.
Definitely. All right. So watch Multiverse of Madness in theaters. And just enjoy the rest of your day, guys. We love you all. Thank you for supporting the show, especially now that it's under my ownership now. I run this shit. I'm the boss. And Sicily, thank you for all of your support, even though you are not getting paid for this.
It is what it is.
Yep. All right, everyone. So please just enjoy the rest of your day, and we will see you Tuesday.
Bye.